Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
And it must be Wednesday evening again. Welcome to the Voice of Indie podcast, show number 65. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me, as usual, is my cohort, Mr. Stephen Jeeves. How you doing tonight, Stephen?
I am just nifty, keen, fine, dandy, and not wearing my shoes, which we covered before the show. But I went and saw Dune last night, Dune Part 1, and man, that was fantastic. I read that book when I was in high school in the 1970s and knew at the time that was something that would never be made into a movie because you just can't do it with that kind of a story, that big, that epic, that bold, so much special effects and all that. And they did it. They pulled it off. This was one of the best science fiction movies I've ever seen. I give it my hearty endorsement. Also saw one of the critics said, Timothy Chalamet, the star, said, if you don't think he's the real deal by now, watch this movie. And I agree with it. And that kid, he played that character just right on. So everything about that movie was great. I loved it. I endorse it. And I'm kind of proud that we have the Ort Chronicles series as part of Fresh Ink Group by Robert G. Willis-Croft, which reminds me of that epic space, all other races, politics and money and all the different things that go into it. So, you know, I'm looking forward to watching the Ort Chronicles series grow into something like that. But if you're a fan of Dune and you got turned off by that one they made way back with Kyle MacLachlan starring, that's the biggest mess of a movie I ever saw. Don't let that put you off. Go see the new one.
Okay. All right. Listeners, if you want to participate in tonight's show, you can call in or hit us on Twitter, and here's how.
Call 516-453-9902 right now and join us on air or tweet us with the hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body, and we'll read your comment or question live. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group.
All right. Jay Ash Looney's Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy was published print-wise today, and the ebooks this week, they'll release a week before Thanksgiving. That's the ebooks, Stephen?
Everything's going to be released the week before Thanksgiving. We go into pre-sale generally for about a month before we release our books, and when we publish them, they go into pre-sale.
All right.
So you got about a month to get your order in on that. And then it's the Tuesday before the Thursday of Thanksgiving is the release day. Tuesday or Wednesday, but right before Thanksgiving is when those will be delivered. We also raised the price on the hardcover of Hello Chattanooga by newscaster David Carroll. He had priced that at $40 and winced a little bit because it's 710 pages in full color. And the hardcover edition, of course, has the hardcover and a dust jacket, and it's an expensive book to print. And so he kind of kept it tight at $40, and he's selling hardcovers faster than softcovers, and people are loving it and not blinking at the price. So we raised the price. That's a rare thing for us to do, but we bumped it up to $44.95 for the hardcover. Still a great value, one great book. A lot of people are buying two, he said, a softcover and a hardcover. They want the hardcover for the shelf, like as a keepsake edition, and then they're dog-earing their softcover edition, showing pictures to people. But that's Hello Chattanooga by David Carroll. Watch for it to start appearing in the retailers any minute now.
All right. Legacy of Danger by Patricia A. Guthrie, whom we had on here last week. That's in pre-sale, so get out there and grab a early copy of it or reserve your copy. This will be released on Halloween, October 31st, so get out there and grab your copy and help boost those, bump that sales up, bump that number. That's important, too, for indie authors. those pre-sales are important, because when you order it through pre-sale and that book is released, I mean, that's a pretty good bump for sales position, and that, you know, that helps other people see it. So get out there and pitch in, lend a hand. And if you haven't signed up for our newsletter telling you about this show and about these kind of book releases, here's how you can do that.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Inquiry with our weekly digital newsletter. New releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
What? Now, I mentioned Federation, the Second Ort Chronicle by Robert G. Williscroft. We are working on that, and that should be released, we're hoping, you know, like sometime in the next week or so. Go into pre-sale, and then, you know, probably have 3 or 4 weeks of pre-sale period before the actual release. So that's the Second Ort Chronicle. Those of you familiar, the first one was Icicle. And that's just that's a rip-roaring space opera, epic, all over the universe kind of a story. Not too much unlike Dune. And we strongly recommend that. Watch for that going into pre-sale soon.
All right. We are hard at work behind the scenes getting Girl, Where's Those Shoes by Jenny Wong ready for imminent release. So keep an eye on the newsletter. Keep an eye on Twitter. Keep an eye on the Fresh Ink Group Facebook page, because we'll be making those announcements when that's ready. And if you happen to miss any episode of this show, we've got all kinds of places where you can find them.
If you miss a show, find us in the archive in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, on Spotify, or under the podcast tab at freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. On YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe.
All right.
Yeah, we picked up another subscriber this week. I got up and did my little happy dance. Then I had to sit down and rest after that, you know, but you know, we aim for the ropes. Our guy Sam has his own channel, and several channels, in fact, on YouTube, and he puts things on there. And he posted a video this week. He's got a yellow classic Volvo station wagon, and he found a guy with a blue one, and he made a 45-minute video about them comparing their two cars. Stuck that on YouTube, and I saw it right after he posted it, and I put a comment on there, and he had like 5 or 6 views. And I left that tab open. A couple hours later, I went back, looked, refreshed it, and he was up to 1,100 views in a couple of hours. That's what we need, people, and we need you to get out there and do that for us. So get on that, please.
Yeah, definitely. We do have some upcoming international shows. Pretty much everybody that we've had on the show so far has been here in the States. But we have an author in Sweden. She's a bestseller. Her name is Astrid Vijay. So she will be doing a pre-recorded show, because the time differences, this is at 8 o'clock here, and it's like, I can't even remember, like 4 o'clock in the morning where she's at, or 3 o'clock, it's 3 o'clock in the morning where she's at. And same thing for Nicholas Rossis. He's an author and a media guru. And many of you who have listened to the old show that I was doing, he was on there a few times. He's calling in from Greece. So that's another pre-recorded show, because his is 4 o'clock in the morning. And he said, let's change the time there. And we're actually going to do another one from Dubai. Aisha Ihsan, she's the daughter of a Pakistani military leader, and she teaches at the University of Dubai. She will be up at 4 a.m., so she's going to do her episode live. So keep that in mind, and it's just an interesting take on authors from around the world.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Speaking of authors, if you are an author and you haven't published yet, or even if you have published and you want to get your manuscript checked out, doing a manuscript evaluation, Fresh Ink Group does that, and here's how you can find out.
Got a manuscript you want the pros to see? FreshInkGroup.com's homepage has a free evaluation button. Share your best work with the members at Fresh Ink Group.
Now, we got a couple of announcements. We want to remind all you authors out there that if you're placing books that you want to have print versions in hand at Christmas. The cutoff for ordering through all of Ingram's companies is November 5th. So you've got, what, 8 or 9 days here to get your orders in to be guaranteed to have those before Christmas. The next day, November 6th, printing prices are going up 6%. It's kind of rare for them to go up, and I've never seen them go up a big jump like that. So a big 6% increase, that's enough reason to try to get your book orders in early as well. And one last announcement there. Those of you who use cream paper, most of the printing companies are having trouble getting cream paper now. So all of the Ingram companies are offering the substitute called eggshell groundwood, which looks about the same to me. So I talked to Lauren about that briefly this afternoon, and we can really only think of Robert McKenzie as the only one who's doing his book with us on cream paper. But if we think of any more, we'll get a hold of you individually and let you know. You might need to check a box and opt in on that one. But other than that, we've got an interesting guest today. Not that the last 60-something guests haven't been interesting. His name is Gilbert Poole, convicted of murder and sentenced to life at age 22. Gilbert Poole served 32 years before Michigan's new attorney general reopened the case. One of the first in her new conviction integrity unit, the evidence was thoroughly discredited and Mr. Poole was exonerated and released. Now, just a few months into his journey to adapt to a very different world, his family long passed away, he is continuing to develop the talents he discovered in prison, painting and drawing and writing, even as he builds on the faith he found during his last years. Now he is overwhelmed with international media attention and looking forward to new opportunities. And with that, welcome to the show, Mr. Poole.
Welcome, Gilbert.
Hey, Glenn. And venture to say that you're going to up your star power here and increase your following here quite a bit.
Well, that's what we're hoping for.
They're coming out of the woodwork to talk to you these days, huh?
Absolutely.
So, Gilbert, tell us where you're from.
I am from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. When I was there last, it was a nice little quaint little town, reminiscent of the Mayberry that you saw on TV. But it's probably not the same way anymore. But it was a nice little slow town back in the hills of North Carolina.
So where else have you lived besides North Carolina? What's your trajectory around the world?
Well, I moved from North Carolina back in 1984 to Michigan, and I stayed up here for a while, but it was difficult to keep a job up here because it was a union state. I was a plumber, so I didn't stay long up here. I could get a job, but I just couldn't keep one. So I moved back down to North Carolina. I haven't moved around a lot. Eventually, I came back up here to Michigan at the courtesy of the Michigan Department of Corrections Transportation Service.
So where are you now?
Yeah, where are you living now?
Now I'm residing in the wonderful town of Lansing, Michigan, where all the politicians are.
So, yeah, that's right in my neck of the woods.
Right. I figured I had to situate myself right in the middle of them to be heard. Less travel time. Less travel time to the Capitol.
So what was it like growing up in South Carolina?
Well, I've never been to South Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina.
North Carolina.
I'm working on a book about South Carolina right now called In the Water, and I just spent all afternoon typing Green Pond, South Carolina into things.
North Carolina. Actually, I have been to South Carolina. That was a joke. North Carolina, it's when I was there, you got to realize this was 35 years ago when I was there. It was a really backwoods. You don't see the police unless you call them. Barefoot, back roads, just slap a plate on a car and take off. You know, you don't really have to be a licensed driver. It didn't matter. Just that kind of country feel to it. I imagine it's not that way anymore. But it was really laid back. Find a lake, go down, go swimming. It was just country all the way.
You were living with your parents?
Yeah. For the most part, I guess I left when I was 16 years old. I moved out.
What did your parents do?
My mother was, she worked for a tobacco company down there. She was a factory worker. My father, I couldn't tell you. Stepdad was, he was a plumber. And as a kid, I would have to work with him doing plumbing work. And thus, I picked up the trade. So when I ventured out on my own, I had the ability to weasel my way into the plumbing industry by working on jobs, construction jobs as a helper, and then eventually worked my way up to working as a plumber under the supervision of other plumbers. So I guess that's the start of my skill set, but it definitely expanded when I went to prison.
Great. We're going to go ahead and run a commercial right now, and then we got some tweets when we get back. This commercial is for another Fresh Ink Group author who spent decades in prison in Michigan. You might have crossed paths with him, Phil Lippert. This is his book, Crimes and the People Who Commit Them.
Phil Lippert was thrown into the bowels of the Michigan Department of Corrections as a 17-year-old adolescent. He remained entrenched in a world of malfeasance for the next 40 years. With astonishing honesty, he reveals the raw details of what a life of incarceration looks like from the inside. His observations of human behavior and his stellar ability to tell a story reveal the courage and resilience of a man who has survived horrifying and savage injustice. Sometimes tragic, but often humorous and redemptive, Crimes and the People Who Commit Them offers a poignant collection of stories and miscreants and corrupt institutions, tales of men who have made poor choices and suffered grave consequences. Through it all, Phil Lippert displays a sly sense of humor and the quiet wisdom of a man who is, ultimately, a survivor. Lippert's journey has been one of an unrequited longing for freedom. Crimes and the People Who Commit Them is proudly published in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats, available worldwide.
All right. Yeah, that's a cool book.
Yeah, and I'm picturing the Willis Croft saying, turn that music down.
I can hear it now.
Phil Lippert. I don't believe I met him.
Yeah, you might have, but just never really knew it. But it's an excellent book. And, it's like our second or third bestseller right now. It's really moving.
Yeah, just some incredible short stories. Some of them are loosely based on real life, but most of them are just incredible fiction. I mean, the guy's got definitely got a skill.
So what are you seeing on Twitter there, Beam?
Over on Twitter, we do have a couple of comments. Verwine Greenhoe, he's chiming in. He said, my wife is a big fan of Dune. Now she says I got to take her to see it. LOL. Thanks, Steven.
We got an IMAX down here if he won't take you.
Dr. Helen Burrell, she says, great good fortune and well wishes to Mr. Gilbert Poole Jr. It's a crime he was imprisoned wrongly all those years. Now I'm on the edge of my seat, eager to read what he will publish about his experiences, both locked away and out to freedom.
Yeah, you know what's impressive here is she managed to get Leonardo DiCaprio to participate in this tweet.
I see that. Speaking of Robert Willis Croft, he says, turn that music down. No, I'm just kidding. He says, if I remember correctly, Frank Herbert, author of Dune, approached 38 publishers who all rejected him before he found a small Pacific Northwest publisher willing to take a chance. It became the best-selling book of all time. Wow.
Yeah, I can't confirm the exact number, but I do remember it was up there like 35, 40, something like that, that he had got a lot of rejections. There's a lot of big, classic, highly successful books that went through that kind of process. Now, as far as my books, I'm still in the middle of that process. I all the rejection, but none of the success yet. But, you know, we're working on it.
Yeah. Verwayne Greenhall also said, this is kind of touting the newsletter. He said, the first email I read when I got up on Wednesday, when I get up on Wednesday mornings, is the one from Fresh Ink Group. So every Wednesday morning, you will get that newsletter if you're not already signed up for it. So,
you know, I had a mentor that kind of guided me through the writing industry while I was in prison. And he once said that you're not a writer until you get 100 rejections under your belt. So,
all right. So what do you do for hobbies? Any interests that you have, Gilbert? How do you spend your time?
Wow. You know, I had a lot of hobbies. I was a up-and-coming artist, which I did a lot of copying of the old masters to learn the techniques, and then I ventured out into my own style of painting. That was very enjoyable, and it helped me pass the time in prison. And I've achieved a little bit of success in selling some of that artwork. But since I've left prison, I have not picked the brushes back up. You know, I have them all around me, just haunting me, trying to get me to throw some paint at the canvas. But, you know, this bold new world I'm in has this allure to it. All the electronics I have to learn just to get by. I have not got back to the painting yet. But eventually, I'll either paint something or put it away. That's my philosophy. If I leave it sitting in my face all the time and I'm tripping over it every day, I'm either going to use it or get rid of it. So,
that's understandable. I mean, a 32-year timeout where you went in and it was a whole different world from what it is now that you came back out.
Absolutely. You know, before 5 months ago, I'd never seen a cell phone before. When I went to prison, they didn't even have the internet. We had standalone computers, Apple IIe with a dial-up modem.
Yeah.
I was introduced to the world of laptops while I was in prison. I studied legal research and studied the law pretty much the whole time I was in there, trying to get myself out. But along the way, I learned quite a few skills that could be applied to other people's cases. And I became a legal writer in the prison system through the legal writer program that the state offered. And it was supervised by a law firm out in the free world. And I would write briefs for prisoners that had some sort of disability that put them kind of behind the rest of the group. You know, I kind of bring them up to speed. And I tell you, the writing skills that I picked up earlier in my bit or in my prison sentence really came in handy as far as legal writing. So I've attached myself to this concept of helping other people with the legal process here. I'm not a lawyer, but I know a little bit more than the average guy, probably just enough to get myself in trouble. But I've been kind of sticking with the legal aspect and legal advocacy after I got out of prison. So I've kind of been immersed in between two worlds here, learning the electronics and being an advocate on the legal side, and kind of being outspoken and informative to the lawmakers that make the laws, and trying to affect some change since I've been out.
It's kind of obvious when you think about, you know, what kind of big changes would happen over the course of decades. Person goes away and then comes back to a different world. But it's not just the technology and stuff that changes, too. It's just that it seems like the whole experience would be overwhelming. I know another guy who was a lifer, and over the years I've hired artists out of prisons to do artwork for books, probably 5, 6, 7 of them, I think, over the years, even book covers a couple of times. And this guy was an artist, and he wound up doing 40-something, 44 years or something like that for a murder that he didn't commit. And I looked at his file and agreed. They didn't have any evidence of any of this. And he wound up being released just about a month ago as part of Kim Worthy's program that she was doing to try to get people out of prison. And you're familiar with that. But this guy, when I was talking to him afterwards, he said that he went to a Myers, which is basically like a Walmart, for those of you who don't know the area, because he needed like shampoo and toothpaste and stuff. And he said he stood there at the end of the aisle looking at 400,000 brands of toothpaste as far as he could see. And the shampoo aisle was like that. And he said that he's just stood there and just felt overwhelmed and was almost in tears because it was like, how do I pick one? How do I pick one? He had spent most of his life checking the little box on the commissary list that says toothpaste. And that was all the decision he ever had to make, you know?
Wow.
So yeah, the technology is a big thing, but just, you know, I've tried to imagine what some of these people are going through. And Gil, you know, it's amazing how you're not totally overwhelmed, curled up in a fetal position and just like, people, leave me alone for a little bit. I'm still trying to pick my brand of toothpaste, you know?
Well, you know, you know, people don't see me behind closed doors, so I'll leave it at that. It has been quite overwhelming at times. I cannot shade the fact that I came out of there a very I don't know, let's say a traumatized individual. It was nearly a month before I could go into a grocery store and feel comfortable. I went into a store, you know, probably the first day I was out with somebody, and I could not wait to get out of there. It was just too sensory overload, too much, too quick. And I'm still feeling that way in certain aspects. It's been a journey. But as far as being overwhelmed by the amount of choices of products he had out there, I am amazed at the stuff that you can get on the internet. Amazon.
Yeah.
This is absolutely incredible. I have to pull in the reins sometimes to keep from spending money I don't have.
You know, that's talking about the changes and all that. I mean, Stephen, you know, you talked about the big changes, but I mean, even like the small changes, when you went in, Kmart was a thriving corporation and it's gone now. You can't go to the Kmart, something familiar. Sears is gone.
They don't have Kmart anymore?
No.
Actually, they do have a couple.
There's a handful of them in other states. The last one here in Michigan just closed down last month. That was in Marshall, Michigan, and that was the last one in the state and had been the last one in the state for like 3 or 4 years.
Yep. And they just tore down the last one down here last month.
Man, I think I still had something on layaway on the Kmart.
Kmart was a marketing client of mine back when they started going downhill. So that says something good about me, huh?
You know, I just realized I haven't seen any advertisements. They don't have layaway anymore, do they? Does anybody know what layaway is?
Yeah, they do actually.
Target and Walmart do that. Christmas. It's Christmas time they do it. I don't think they do them full time year round anymore like Kmart did.
Kind of like phone booths.
At least they don't add, phone booths, pay phones. Gone.
So let's throw another commercial in here and keep knocking these out, Beam. How about Whoopi?
All righty.
Every person has a private life and a secret self. This is true of those we know and people we only know because they are famous. Discover fascinating, intimate, clever, witty, poignant, insightful tales
from a diverse roster of notable women who dare reveal both the unknown and the previously undisclosed. But these are not gossipy tales. No, they are personal, anecdotal, always meaningful stories for quiet reading, sharing aloud, even performing from the stage. Compiled by Detroit playwright Jay Ajluni, Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy, 65 fascinating excerpts from the memoirs of famous and infamous women is illustrated with whimsical portraits that capture these remarkable celebrities at their best. Choose your own from laminate hardcover, softback, and digital editions, all proudly published by Fresh Ink Group. Come away with a richer appreciation of these talented women and smile for permitting them to entertain you in unexpected and delightful ways.
Yeah, I think Mr. Ajluni is going to have a popular book on his hands when this is out.
Well, definitely. Especially when people see that very cool video that we made for it, all animation, over on YouTube, Fresh Ink Group channel. Subscribe and like.
Did it happen, Crispy Bacon?
I didn't hear that. You cut out.
Did it have any crispy bacon in it?
No. We're still working on that new Adobe scratch and sniff feature that you, where you can put right in videos, put some bacon smell in there while you're watching the video. Somebody's going to believe that anyway.
Yeah. Over on Twitter, throw this out here. Marlena Smith tweeted. She said, "Great show tonight on the Voice of Indy podcast. Tune in now." So she's out there promoting the show. Thank you, Marlena. Appreciate that.
So the way that I got to know Gil Poole way, way long ago was when I was doing volunteer teaching of story writing classes in prisons throughout Michigan, or throughout South Michigan. And Gil Poole was one of my students, and he was very impressive, and I made it a point to keep up with him and keep track of him. What all kind of stuff did you do in prison besides take that writing class, Gil, to get yourself ahead, learn, and move forward, even when things didn't look so good?
Well, you know, I had a few things I used to occupy my time. I did leathercraft. I made greeting cards and sold greeting cards. But let's not skirt over the fact of the writing, because that was developmental in my evolution here. If it wasn't for those writing classes and my introduction to grammar and the whole mechanic of writing, I would probably still be in prison, because these skills are so essential to communicate with other people exactly what you want to say in an effective way. Just a misplaced comma can change the whole sentence. So taking those early mechanics classes, you know, English and writing, and developing story writing skills, outlining skills, it was absolutely essential for my legal writing process and learning how to draft comprehensive briefs and tell a story, tell somebody's story, anybody's story that I'm writing about in a way that is succinct but gets the point across. You have to capture the audience very quickly in the legal writing, and the writing skills was absolutely essential to my release. I just wanted to make that point before we moved any further into the crafts field here. But I picked up painting, card making, leathercraft. I did a few ceramics, not much. But while I was in there, I picked up sewing skills. I worked in a sewing factory making clothes for the officers. Yeah, so I worked in a sewing factory for many years, probably 12 years. So during that time, I was pretty much concentrating on the sewing and legal work, studying the law books, reading all I can. So next question.
So now doing the painting, I've seen many of your paintings. You started that in prison? You weren't painting, you know, before you got in prison?
No, I was not. Actually,
wow.
That's impressive.
That is.
That was born of hunger. When you see other people eating stuff, well, I call it gas station food, but it's just the food that we would be able to buy out of the commissary, out of the prisoner store, you know, so we could make our own food instead of eating the unidentifiable mess that they give us in the dining room. So if you see other people eating, we call them cook-ups, ramen noodles with the cheeses and the meats and the you know, made up really nice. Back in the earlier days, we had, you know, other things like chicken and pizza we could buy, but that's gone with the times. But still, you sit around and you watch other people eating these immaculate contraptions that they've put together out of the prisoner store, and you just say, wow, you know, I'd like to have some of that, but that costs money. So so how do you earn money in prison? Well, you have to develop a skill or a talent that other people are seeking, and greeting cards, sending cards out to family and friends. You know, that was one aspect, that was one way of earning money, is you make greeting cards for other people. And I started out by tracing cartoon characters and finding patterns, you know, to trace on the cards. But eventually, other artists would come along with something hand-painted, you know, free-handed, and it kind of pushed me out of the business there, you know, because I'm not selling my traced, you know, cartoon characters anymore, because here comes somebody, you know, painting flowers or doing some other portrait-like work. So I had to up my game, develop that skill. So off and running, I'll buy the textbooks and learn from whoever I can and learn how to paint. And,
so it's like a closed economy, huh? You're selling your work to other prisoners and maybe even to staff as well?
Absolutely.
Huh.
It's a very, very inexpensive for them, for the purchaser. But it serves a purpose, you know. You get the ramen noodles and that tub of cheese spread, you know, and you're off and running. Or maybe some pop, you know. Oh, yeah. Eventually, my skills developed to where I was able to do portraits and just look at photographs and pretty much replicate a photograph, you know, onto a painting, you know, scale it up or whatever. I just got away from the card making business. My price went up. So instead of having to make 100 cards a month just to get the ramen noodles that I needed and the cosmetics that I needed to get by, you know, now I can make one painting every 2 months and sell it, you know, and get enough to get by on. So, the more developed my skill was, the larger price I could demand for my work. I sit here and look at the art material sitting all around me, you know, as I'm talking about it, and I want to get back into it.
Well, you have some finished pieces there with you now, right?
Absolutely. I went back to some of the people that I've sold them to and purchased them back.
Ooh.
Because
okay.
I know the value of them. And
yeah.
They got them real cheap. So.
But these are not displayed anywhere. You don't have them posted online, or there's no way that people can go take a look at some of your stuff yet?
Not at this point. No, I don't have anything on.
Well, we need to talk about that. You know, maybe give you a page in the Fresh Ink Group site. You can put some things up or get you a website going, because people are curious. They want to see some of these kinds of things. And who knows, something you bought back, you might get an offer for that, you know, time to let it go again. Just rent them out, as it were. But we got some good comments over here on Twitter. Beam, you want to grab one?
Sure. Berwayne Greenhoe, he said, I worked in the psych ward at Riverside in Ionia, Michigan, working to get the men there to get involved in the social life in prison, such as it was. And I was overwhelmed some days with the men I met and their stories. Not everyone in prison is guilty or a bad person.
Yeah, that's right. And then Marlena Smith says, I couldn't imagine going through that big of a transition, so much of an adjustment. I'm so glad you're getting to tell your story, and I look forward to seeing what's next for you. Well, that's a nice sentiment, Marlena.
And listeners, the phone lines are open, so if you want to call in and talk to tonight's guest, Gilbert Poole, that's 516-453-9902, 516-453-9902, or if you want to join in on Twitter, as the others are doing, it's hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of your tweet, and we'll see it.
So you're writing and whatnot. You're putting together things for interviews, for appearances, podcasts, things like that. What kind of stuff are you getting pulled into right now? Your day-to-day interactions with the media?
Well, interactions with the media are pretty much limited to telling my story. There have been a few instances where I've been called to give my perspective before the committees that form the laws. Some forensic committees have called me in to voice my opinion of the system and the way it works. But for the most part, I'm just telling my story. And there's not a lot of writing, not a lot of prepping for that. I love talking about me. my favorite subject.
And you probably have a few opinions, too.
I have to rein it in sometimes.
Yeah.
Consider my audience. I can get quite flavorful and spicy if I want to, but I can pull it back and tailor whatever it is I'm saying to the audience. There is definitely a harder side to the story. We'll avoid the terrifying part of prison and just concentrate on the brighter side of things, of developing skills, and but prison is not a flowery sit back and do crafts and enjoy yourself type of place. Prison is as dangerous as you can imagine, and you got to keep that first and foremost in your mind. So if I'm talking about sitting and doing crafts and doing paintings and that, you got to temper that with the fact that somebody just got stabbed out in the yard, or there's a fight over here in the day room, and you got to watch who's walking around you, because you never see it coming. Sometimes you're not even involved in anything and can get caught up in it. So it's really a war zone that you got to tiptoe around through. And all these other things are just distractions to, like the crafts and the writing, these are just distractions to take your mind off of the things that are happening around you, because it's the worst of the worst that you're incarcerated with. Now, on one hand, there are a lot of people in there that you just can't imagine how they got into prison. But on the other hand, there's a lot of them in there that they're just where they're supposed to be. So, you know, it's really a minefield in there, and you have to navigate this. You never really know who you're talking to. And sometimes the most peaceful people that you're talking to turn out to be some of the most heinous criminals you've ever seen, you know. So it's you just don't know who you're talking to. And I carried that with me when I came out. When I was finally released from prison, I don't trust anybody. I don't care if it's the guy at the gas station.
You know, like I'm walking up behind you.
Taking my credit card. Or sitting there talking to somebody, and they look over my shoulder behind me. I'm thinking they're trying to distract me and get me to turn my head so they can do something. You know, it's just, I liken it to PTSD or traumatic syndrome of some sort, because I don't see things in the same perspective as everybody else. I see everything in a battle from that perspective. If you're in a battle and you're trying to navigate your way through, and everybody has an agenda, so it's a big transition as far as that goes. But the working on the crafts and the skills of painting and leather craft, and even the craft of writing, these are distractions, but they're also skills that I've learned to develop, because, you know, the more I concentrate on it, the more I'm going to learn on it. I hate to be a I don't know what you call him, Steve, a 50-pager, somebody that writes 50 pages and then quits.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I hate to be somebody that starts something and gets halfway through it and then gives up on it and then moves on to something else before they, you know, complete the project or complete the process here. So, I have many irons in the fire. Point in time right now, I have this platform to where I'm able to sit here and tell my story. And there's so many things that take precedent over me proceeding with my art or proceeding with my writing. There's other things I think take priority. And that would be assisting whoever I can and bringing to light the injustice of some of the criminal processes here that got me sent to prison for a crime I didn't commit.
And I want to ask you about the details on that real quick. We want to mention over on Twitter, though, Marlena's saying, that's a great idea, Stephen. I would love to show your work, Gilbert. I have a couple of different sites I can feature you on. That's Marlena Smith. Keep that in mind, Gil.
Oh,
and then,
fantastic.
And Robert Williscroft says, did you experience any of the inter-prisoner actions we often see in the movies, such as gang rivalries, bullying, forced servitorship?
You know, that's the minefield that I was just talking about. That's day-to-day life, gang violence, gang banging, however you want to describe it. If you're not part of the group, you're going to be a victim of the group. So it's a fine line. I was in a unique position to where I was doing legal work for lots of people, and I didn't charge anybody for anything. I did it. This is all free, although this is a lucrative industry in the prison for a lot of people that profess to know legal work, and they would know just enough to charge a guy, mess up his case, and run off with the money. I didn't charge anybody for anything for the simple reason I was trying to help people, and the monetary aspect was not even in my view. But people were grateful for that, so I was able to navigate my way around all the gang violence, because I've helped out half the gang members, you know, with their case, or you know, if anybody needed any help, I didn't have any problem with putting all the effort I could into helping them. So I was able to avoid that aspect of prison life for the most part. Some of it you still have to dance around, but it's definitely prevalent if you're not with them, you're going to be a victim of them. So, and then you have one gang against the other gang, and all the drug trade is just out of control. Everything you see in the movies, yep, it goes on.
So odd as it sounds, you were perceived as a valuable member of the community. You know, you're helping other people out, and, you know, somebody's talking about, hey, let's go hit that guy or whatever. No, that guy's working on my case. You leave him alone, you know. So I guess when you're valuable and respected, then other people look out for you, and it's kind of hands off, I guess. It's funny how that works. But, you know, you want to take the next one for Wayne Beam?
Sure. Let me come over here and see this. Hit that refresh. Oh, yeah. Okay. So Verwayne Greenho, he's here in Michigan as well, Gilbert. He's up in the UP. He says, I worked at Riverside for 2 years, and the mix of men there were very nice. And then there was that small bunch of psychopaths. I met a man there that had made my blood run cold just looking at him.
I'll bet. So, Gil, the question a lot of people are asking is, what is it that got you convicted, and what changed in all those years that enabled you to get out?
Well, when I moved to Michigan, I moved up here to Michigan with a girl I had met in North Carolina. I moved up to Michigan with her because she was from Michigan. That didn't last too long. I broke up with her. But I stayed in Michigan for a while trying to make it work. But like I said, I was a plumber at the time, 22 years old. But Michigan is a union state, and I was not a resident of the state. You have to be a five-year resident of the state to join the union. So I was not able to get a legitimate plumbing job up here. So I had to work short-term employment, working on jobs that the union was not involved in. But eventually I would move on. And it wasn't hard getting jobs. It was just hard keeping jobs up here. So eventually I went just – said, you know, I've had enough of this. I went back to North Carolina. But when I went back to North Carolina, I took a girl I met up here with me. And that turned out to be a big mistake, because this girl I took up from Michigan down to North Carolina. Now, granted, I just told you about how North Carolina was laid back and slow and real country. I took a girl from the city to the country, and she got bored, and she ventured out on her own, and I wasn't with that, you know. So I sent her back to Michigan. I said, you know, you can go back to Michigan. This ain't working out. Well, when she left, she went to the police and asked the police for a ride back to Michigan, and they said, well, you know, we don't do that. She says, well, my boyfriend told me that he was going to kill me. I said, well, that's a threat, but it's still not going to get you a ride back to Michigan. She said, well, he's killed before, and I believe him. Oh, wait a minute. Hold the phone. Pump the brakes. They called Pontiac, Michigan, where she was from, and lo and behold, they had an open murder in Pontiac, a murder that was unsolved for 6 months. And they came down to North Carolina, picked her up with all the belongings out of my house, and brought it up here to Michigan to investigate this claim that she made that I had told her or she knew about me committing a murder in Michigan. Now, this is unbeknownst to me. I didn't know anything about this. They did this while I was not at home. They took all my belongings out of my house. But I figured she took it. Okay, if she needed it, that's fine. But eventually, they tied me to the murder that they found in Michigan, and actually got a warrant for my arrest. So I waived extradition and came up to Michigan. defend these charges. Figured, you know, this is going to be cleared up quickly because it wasn't me. I'm not worried about it. Hired a lawyer out of a phone book. Big mistake. Know your lawyer. Don't pick one out of a phone book.
Or TV commercial.
Yeah, at least get a reference. But the whole trial, this guy was sitting there saying, oh, don't worry about it. The evidence doesn't match you. You're not going to get convicted. Don't worry about it. As the trial progressed, the girlfriend said, I got drunk and told her that I committed a murder in Michigan. So to corroborate her testimony, they brought in a forensic odontologist who is a dentist. A dentist who identifies bodies by comparing the teeth from the corpse to dental records and making a positive identification in that sense. Now, his profession of making identification from teeth, he took that and expanded that pseudoscience into something new to where they were trying to compare teeth to bite mark registrations. Now, that might be a valid science if you're comparing teeth to a bite mark into something solid like an apple or wax or some sort of solid substrate to where you can measure the angulation, the depth, the spacing in between the teeth. That might be a valid science from that aspect. But he took this science to say that a bruise on the victim's arm, a circular bruise, matched my teeth, which is not a reproducible science. This is actually, he had been warned not to make any positive identifications from a bite mark because it was subjective to points of view. No two scientists are going to come up with the same opinion on the matter. However, the court rules allowed this forensic odontologist to give his personal opinion. And in his personal opinion, he professed that the odds of it not being me that bit the victim in a death struggle was 1 in 2.4 billion. The odds of winning the lottery was better. So you have a girlfriend on the stand that says, I told her I killed somebody. Then you have a scientist that the court instructed the jury, this guy has been stipulated to as a scientist, so what he says you can count as true. He gets up and gives his personal opinion that the odds of it not being me that bit the victim was 1 in 2.4 billion, and all dental certainty, I was the perpetrator of the crime. He's buried me. So there's not much defense to that. I mean, if you didn't do something and you had this guy paraded up there with this pseudoscience that the jury was not equipped to discern what he was talking about or to evaluate whether or not what he was saying was true or has any admissibility to it. And a lawyer that was pretty much kicked back in the chair, almost sleeping during the trial, I was found guilty. Actually, when the prosecutor rested his case and it came time for the defense to put on his witnesses, my lawyer says, you know what? I'm good. I don't have a defense. I don't have any witnesses. So he didn't even put on any witnesses or any defense.
Wow. didn't even put it on the record to refute that testimony, huh?
Didn't even attempt it.
So he didn't even preserve it for appeal.
Right. So I actually, he tried to have it excluded prior to trial. He filed a motion before trial to have the testimony vetted before the jury heard it. And the judge granted him the ability to question the expert as far as his methodology and his techniques prior to the jury to ascertain whether it would be admissible. However, that didn't happen. He was just he was called out of turn. The expert was called out of turn, and it was hurried up and did this, and so it was pretty much a sham show. defense. So I was the only one for my defense to get up on the – I said, listen, somebody's got to say I didn't do it. I put myself on the stand, and I said, listen, it was not me. It's not me. That didn't go – that didn't carry a lot of weight against an expert. Every defendant's going to get up there and say that they didn't do it. But that's pretty much how I got convicted. And it stood strong for 32 years.
Wow. We do have a caller. You want to take the call?
Go.
All right. All down here. Hello, caller. You are on the air. Where are you calling from, and what's your name?
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Verwayne.
Hi, Verwayne. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's beautiful night up here in the UP. Cold, but beautiful.
Cold.
I had, you know, I heard a lot of stories exactly like your guest is telling you up there, that back in the 80s, when I suspect you were saying this happened, DNA wasn't a big thing yet, and they in the bite business, now they can clear that up on an old bite, but those early days of bite analysis were way off. And I had seen several guys get wrongly convicted that got theirs turned over 10, 12 years later. But how do you get reimbursed for 10 years, 10, 12 years of your life on a mistake?
Right, right. Absolutely. They started turning cases over long before they turned mine over, but they had a bad case law that allowed it to remain in Michigan. There was a case of People versus Tony Dale Marsh, to where the judge had ruled that the bite mark identification evidence was admissible because the jury was able to see what the expert was holding up as far as x-rays and comparisons and see for themselves. So therefore, the Michigan Supreme Court had ruled it was admissible in the state of Michigan, which created bad case law, which still stands today, I think.
Well, the ecchymosis or bruising of the area there after, I think it's 24 hours, begins to slide over, and you cannot clearly delineate where those teeth start and where the bruise just slid over. I've seen that several times. In fact, I worked the emergency room there for a long time, and you would frequently see bites that were old. You'd see them, you're looking for infection, but you would see them one day, and then the difference in them was just amazing to see them the next day. And
right.
I agree. That was that early quote-unquote science was deeply troubled.
It's how the person practices it, too. The person who testified against Gill has been thoroughly debunked and accused of actually falsifying some of his evidence. And virtually every case he testified in has now been overturned. But I saw one video where they had somebody had pulled out a phone and had gotten video of him holding a cast of a defendant's teeth and looking at the corpse where the bite marks were, trying to line them up, and when they didn't quite line up, he pushed them into the body, pushed the cast of the teeth into where the holes were. Well, they line up now, you know, so.
redefine the evidence.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, it didn't quite match. We'll fix that. And then when you consider, you know, how the body changes and the skin contracts and dries and, you know, rigor sets in, all those kinds of things. It's just mind-boggling to me that they could have considered that definitive, especially with him pulling stunts like pushing the teeth into the wound.
Yeah, that's just,
you know,
crazy there.
These are some of the things that I've been trying to address since I've been out and actually have told my experience in front of the forensic science committees in charge of reassessing the court rules. as far as what an expert is allowed to say and how much leeway is given, because he's taken a legitimate court rule and taken it and twisted it and manipulated it for his own purposes, and that was promoting his own craft, irrespective of the damage he was doing to me. So these court rules and these loopholes need to be tightened up a little bit to where a valid science remains a valid science and opinions stay out of the courtroom.
Well, I think this guy himself should be sitting behind bars. I mean, all the damage that he's done to other people's lives.
Right.
We do have another comment on Twitter. Marlena Smith, she says, I'm a true crime and crime show nerd. I've done a lot of studies myself, and you are blowing my mind. What you went through is unforgivable. There are some truly evil people in this world. Thank God that someone finally took a stand for you, and you were freed. You feeling
Thank
the love,
you.
Gilbert?
Pardon me?
Are you feeling the love?
I'm feeling the love. Marlena. Hit the nail on the head right there.
Yeah.
You know, it was, some people say the stars aligned for my release, because this is a drum I've been beating for 30 years, but I was getting nowhere in the courts. And I've had the Innocence Project from Cooley Law School trying to get me out on DNA testing. Now, there was blood found on the body that did not match the victim. And they got a warrant for my blood, and lo and behold, it did not match me. However, during the trial, when it come time for that expert to testify that there was blood found at the scene that did not match me and did not match the victim, he was sick. That scientist was sick. So they had another scientist reproduce the test that the prosecutor wanted to use, and that was not one of the test that she reproduced. So the actual scientist that could have gave exculpatory evidence that would have excluded me did not testify. So instead of his testimony, the lawyers and the prosecutor said, Your Honor, this expert is not available due to illness. He's on the phone if the defense wants to talk to him, but we have his report here, and we can enter his report into the evidence if the jury wants to see it. But it just says it's just redundant. It just says all the blood they tested belonged to the victim, which that was a lie, because one of the blood tests that he did on some stones that was embedded in the guy's clothing did not match the victim. And if the jury was aware that the blood on the stones did not match the victim and did not match me either, then the story changes. However, the manipulation by the prosecutor and the bold lie that he told the jury, nobody looked at the report, because he has dissuaded them from doing so, because it was just some random test, you know, just been repeated 1,000 times. So nobody really looked at it. I'm quite adamant that if you just look at the report, it says that I'm excluded. And Cooley Law School picked up my case based upon that, I'm sure, to get DNA testing done of that blood, because that would provide new evidence to open the case back up. Because I've already exhausted my appellate remedies and been down through there on my own through the courts trying to get my case overturned, and I got nowhere. So in order for the law school to get back up in there, they had to have new evidence to open the case back up. So new evidence was going to come in the form of DNA testing of that blood, if they can find it. And we spent nearly a decade trying to get them to release the blood or release the evidence. Well, I actually admitted it exists first of all, they said it didn't exist. Huh. So we couldn't. They said we couldn't prove it exists. Well, once we finally, through exhaustive manipulation, proved that it exists and is being held in the Michigan State Police evidence locker. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, you got us. It does exist, and we have it right here.
That's sickening.
And we continue to want to. So, but then the opposition came. Well, the jury was already aware of this because this report was in evidence. But wait a minute. They weren't aware. They were told that the evidence says it was all the victim's blood. It wasn't. So the report was there, but nobody looked at it. So then we had that battle. Then we had the battle of, well, the defendant, Mr. Poole, has already tried to adjudicate this before. So it comes up to res judicata. It's already been adjudicated by a higher court, and we can't reopen it. Oh, it was one barrier after the other. Finally, one court allowed the DNA testing of the evidence. And the court rules changed that allowed, if there was a new scientific opinion regarding the evidence, then the case can be reopened and reevaluated. At that same time, the Michigan Attorney General opened up her own conviction integrity unit to cover the rest of the state. Now, Wayne County, Tim Worthy in Wayne County had a conviction integrity unit running down there in Wayne County and had exonerated probably 26, 27 people before Dana Nessel opened it up for the rest of the state. Now, that was just concentrated in Wayne County. Can you imagine the number of convictions that were wrongful convictions for the rest of the state if you had the resources to dig into and look at all the cases that were had some allegations of some misconduct in it? But as it were in my case, we had new evidence as far as the DNA testing goes. The DNA testing was ordered, and the DNA testing was performed, but they did not come up with a conclusive result. In other words, there was not enough of a profile there to make identification of any one in particular because there was not enough markers there. However, the science had changed to where they can now fill in with computer programs and models. They can fill in some of the blanks now and actually have a comparable DNA strain. So we have the new evidence of the DNA markers. The conviction integrity unit under the state attorney general's office opened up and decided to take a look at my case. So now we have the stars aligning. We have new evidence. We have the conviction integrity unit taking a look at my case, and that allows them to take another look at this bite mark identification testimony, this absolutely ridiculous testimony that they convicted me with. And then we have DNA evidence that excludes me, 100% excludes me as the contributor of the sample. So the Attorney General's office assigned a group of investigators to go through and actually vet every claim, every piece of evidence in that case. And they took an entire year to go through the evidence, one piece at a time, and found absolutely nothing that tied me to the crime. There was nothing scientifically viable evidence to tie me to the crime at all, whatsoever. And at the end of the day, Dana Nessel in the Conviction Integrity Unit, Robin Finkel, Lori Montgomery, Marla Mitchell from the Innocence Project, together, collectively, petitioned the court for my release. May 26th of this year, Judge Chabot said, I'm sorry, you can go, and let me go.
Wow.
3 hours later, I was packing my stuff up in the prison, and they were calling count as I was walking out the door. Everybody stepped out of their door and cheered for me as I walked out of the prison.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's how I came to be where I'm at now. And that was just 5 months ago.
That'd be a nice scene in the movie.
Yeah.
It was.
Robert Willis Croft, he's got a quick comment here. He says, Shakespeare had an elegant solution to your lawyer problem.
Yeah, a very elegant one. It, you know, it still boggles my mind that a state attorney general would go out like that and advocate and actually go for fairness and you know, because usually their stick is, you know, the finality. You got to, you know, let everybody move on and stuff like that, except for the guy who got wrongfully convicted. Forget him.
You know,
but,
I think,
you know,
I think that was the first time in the country that the chief law enforcement officer of the state attorney general actually went to bat for a guy's release.
Yep.
Now,
wow.
That's why my case has drawn such a wide attention. It's gone international.
There's a situation there. I mean, in so many instances, it's not about right and wrong anymore. They don't care. It's about, like Stephen said, you know, let people move on or whatever. They don't care about right or wrong. In many instances, they know that the evidence shows, you know, something different from the actual conviction, but they're willing to write it out because a lot of these people are going to go for reelection. Hey, look, this person's tough on crime. You know, it keeps them in the system. It keeps them in a career.
You know, in other cases, since I've been out, we've tried to petition for other conviction integrity units in other states. For example, Missouri. There's a case of Kevin Strickland. He was convicted in 1979 of a triple homicide. But it's, by all accounts, he was innocent. He was wrongfully convicted. However, the state attorney general down there decided that for political reasons, that he does not want to overturn a conviction. It was a valid conviction, and no, he's not arrested. So that's one instance there where, you know, we have parts and pieces in place to right injustices, and it goes a long ways. A testimony to their character about how they can set aside their partisanship and political slant in order to do the right thing, because it has nothing to do with political parties. It has nothing to do with ethnicity or any of these, all about correcting a wrong. If they can bite the bullet and say, listen, sorry, we were wrong, aside from the potential litigation afterwards and everything, let's correct it. If a man has to stay in prison one more day, that's ridiculous. If you're going to base that upon, oh, well, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat or, you know, it's a, people have to set aside these political motivations and just do the right thing. Actually visit the cases where the allegations are made and actually look at the cases, because anytime you have human participation, there's going to be screw-ups and there's going to be people that do stupid stuff. And I don't care if you're law enforcement or officer. I don't care if you're – I mean – Look at the things that's been exposed since the advent of the personal video camera. All of a sudden, the police are not so pristine because you can actually see it for yourself. Well, it's always been that way because you have human interaction. You know, everybody's not going to be holier than thou. but now it's starting to come to light. And now people are starting to take a second look. And after people are starting to take a second look, lo and behold, look how many people have been released because of misconduct in some way, shape, or form. Now, I'm not saying that we have a bad system. I can't point to another country that has a better justice system. I don't know of any, but it might be. I don't know. But I'm saying this is the best one I know of, and it can still be the best one in the world. We just have to work at it because everything has fallibility to it. And if you just get over your pride and say, you know what, we screwed up there, and release some of these guys, because there are so many people I left behind that I hear these stories. Like I said, I was working as a legal writer, and I heard stories after stories after stories to where people did not belong in prison, but for technicalities, but for this manipulation of evidence, but for this misplaced evidence, guys wind up in prison. And it's really clogging up the system. If you go through and finance, and this is probably key and foremost here, is financing these programs and supporting these conviction integrity units that go through and investigate these claims. That's the only way you're going to make repairs to a system that has chunks missing out of the wheels. You know, you have to be able to support the correction of it. There's a lot of people that want to do the right thing, but they just don't have the resources. The conviction integrity unit of the state attorney general's office is very small, and she's serving the whole state. Kim Worthy has done a phenomenal job down in Wayne County. I think she's had 30 people exonerated. She's released 30 people through her conviction integrity unit in Wayne County over, I think it's like 5 years now. That's absolutely remarkable.
You would think the citizens would want that.
Pardon me?
You would think the citizens would want that. I mean, so many of these, you know, prosecutors, attorneys general, and all of them, they're reluctant to do this because it's political and they don't want to be seen as soft on crime. Somebody's going to make a commercial saying he's letting killers out or whatever. But your average citizen, you would think, would want to look to these people and see integrity, see a willingness to admit a mistake and undo a wrong and things like that. Wouldn't you feel better about your entire legal system knowing that the people have some integrity up there at the higher levels?
You know, I don't know what her motivations is behind that, but I can only say that she's doing the right thing and she's making it work with the resources she has. And it's an example, it's a model for other places in the country to start their own units and try. They're very hardest to work it out because it's not a popular subject. It's not a popular thing to say. For a police department to come in and say, well, we don't trust some of our workers, you know, because that's exactly what they're doing is they're stepping up and saying, you know, our own workers have been screwing up and we need to fix it. So it's not a popular thing to do, but it's the right thing to do.
No.
And
there needs to be more accountability for those that are falsifying evidence or withholding evidence. I mean, that's the big thing that I read in articles in the newspaper all the time. It's, you know, it's like, well, they finally got a hold of this evidence that had been withheld for a year. They just found it. You know, it's like your blood in the police locker up there. It's just amazing. And there is no accountability for that. You don't get in trouble for withholding evidence and sending somebody to prison wrongly. You just go to the next case. It's no big deal. We do have a question on Twitter from Marlena. She wants to know what happened to the woman who falsely accused you or who lied about the you saying that you talked to her when you were drunk. Was there any retribution for her for doing that?
You know, I think karma caught up to her. I have no idea where she was at prior to my release. But since my release, I've heard that she has been married, goes by the name of Connie Johnson now, and I think she was incarcerated for bank robbery. Her and her husband and another man here in Michigan had attempted to rob three banks, and the third one kind of went exploded on them, and they all got caught with red-handed beak. I think she was a turned witness against her husband and the other guy, and probably got the snitch deal out of it. So she was incarcerated for a minute here in Michigan for bank robbery. I don't know whether she still is or not, but it's not
Marlene.
My job. She's gonna do herself in.
Hmm. Yeah, Marlena says we need a we're gonna need a part two.
Yeah, we are just about out of time. Gil, how do people get a hold of you if they want to send you a note, some congratulations, a card with some money in it? Who knows what people might send?
Well, I am on Facebook. It's I have an email address, gilbert.poole@icloud.com, or you can look me up on Facebook.
And, of course, we have the contact form at freshinkgroup.com. Send us a note, and we can always pass along messages or hook people up. Get in touch. So thanks for coming today, Gil. This was definitely very interesting and an eye-opener for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like I say, I talked about me, but I really opened my eyes to the system and the way things are, because people aren't really aware of the ins and outs of the criminal justice system. They just see the end result on TV and say, yep, they got the good guy, or they got the bad guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
All right, so people, subscribe to the newsletter, which is on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com, and we will give you updates about what's going on with Mr. Poole, what's happening with his art, with his writing. We're definitely talking to him about some books because we think there would be big demand from people interested in his story. I'll bet we could sell at least two copies to Marlena Smith alone.
Yeah. So listeners, next week, be sure to tune in. Author Joan Hall will be joining us, and we'll be talking about her work. So tune in for that.
And after that, novelist Aisha Ihsan will be live from Dubai. She's getting up at 4:00 in the morning for us.
And after that, from... not live, this will be pre-recorded, from Sweden, Astrid Vijay, also an author. She will be talking about her New York or USA Today bestseller. So tune in for that.
And then another recorded show, Nicholas Rossis from Greece. We're longtime friends with Nick, both Beam and I. We've known him for a while now. He's an excellent author, writes a lot of stuff from children's to how-to. But he's also a media guru. He's the guy that we talk to when we want to know, what's Amazon doing? What's going on? What are all these changes? How do we navigate this? And he's always right on. He's not only in the know, but he puts the stuff out there for everybody. So that's a blog that you're going to want to subscribe to as well. That's Nick Ross.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thanks, people. And thanks again, Gil.
Thanks, Gil. Talk to you all. We'll talk to you guys next week.
All right, bye.
Bye.
You've been a part of Voice of Indie, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.